This is partly audiobook on extracts, made via unwisdom.com, published there in 2020, on book. Our story of Atlantis, of W.P. Fellon. First about this man. William P. Fellon was a noted theosophist, who, in 1903, together with his wife, Myra, wrote this, Our Story of Atlantis, in which they predicted that the continent of Atlantis would reappear above the Atlantic waters, within the following century and stretch from the coast of Africa to the southern USA. So far Atlantis has failed to surface. Fellon claims that the wisest scientists at E.M. of his day supported the possibility of the existence of an island continent in the neighborhood, if not directly over the great West Indian archipelago. Fellon cites the now discredited Augustus Leplongeon, who claimed that the inscriptions on the Mexican pyramid at Xochitlo were partly Egyptian. This foray into the world of fantasy may explain why it was Mr. and Mrs. Fellon who recommended the admission of L. Frank Baum, the author of The Wizard of Oz, into the Ramayana Theosophical Society in 1892. Personal life and career. William Pike Fellon was born September 28, 1834 in England to Benjamin and Sarah Fellon. His father was a clergyman. The family, including a brother Benjamin, emigrated to the United States and by 1850 was settled in Rhode Island. William married Ruth Lamira Morse, known as Myra or Myra, who was born in Vermont on April 1, 1831. She was the niece of Samuel Morse, inventor of the telegraph. The early 1860s found the couple living in Dora, Illinois, with William working as a printer for a time. In 1862, during the Civil War, Fellon served in a medical role in the 95th Illinois Infantry, but was discharged with a disability. A son, William A. Fellon, was born around 1870. In the early 1870s, William and Myra Fellon were employed as school teachers in La Porte, Indiana. In 1874 they moved to Chicago. He became established as a physician in the central business district of that city. After his wife Myra died on February 23, 1896 in Chicago, Dr. Fellon moved to San Francisco. He died in San Francisco on December 29, 1904, and his role as head of the Hermetic Brotherhood of Atlantis, Luxa and Elephanta, was prominently featured in his obituary. Theosophical Society involvement. Both William and Myra became members of the Theosophical Society on November 11, 1884. They were active in the Chicago branch, of which Dr. Fellon was corresponding secretary. It was one of the first theosophical lodges formed in the United States. The Fellons helped to form the Ramayana Theosophical Society on July 27, 1887. Both Fellons sponsored L. Frank Baum, author of The Wizard of Oz, and his wife Mrs. Maud G. Baum, when they joined the Ramayana branch on September 4, 1892. Dr. Fellon served as president of the Ramayana T.S., and its meetings took place at 629 Fulton Street, which also served as the doctor's office, the editorial office of the Hermetist, and business address of the Hermetic Publishing Company. Myra was actively engaged in theosophical activities as well. She gave lectures at the lodge, such the poetic presentation a fragment given on June 24, 1888. When the American section of the Theosophical Society held its annual convention in Chicago in 1890, she read a paper called The Narrow Path. Hermetic Brotherhoods. Dr. Fellon and Myra founded the Hermetic Brotherhood of Atlantis, Luxa and Elephanta around 1875. He headed that organization until his death in 1904. He was also editor of its periodical, The Hermetist, published 1887-1899 in Chicago. The Fellons also seem to have been members of the similarly named and better known Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxa that was founded in 1884. It seems that Atlantis was mentioned in another of Baum et M.'s many Oz books, Dorothy and the Wizard. Fellon et M.'s book was republished in 2009, but the original can also can be read online, and extracts further here. Klinner, scribe of the Mighty Three, to whom it has been given strictly in charge so to do. Herein write the history of my beloved country. This is to be for the instruction and enlightenment of my people. I demand for this undertaking the necessary assistance and guidance from the brotherhood of both the invisible and the visible, so soon to become of the invisible, from the gods of wisdom and power, and from the supreme ruler of all, that I may secure that which is best and most instructive concerning the actions and conditions of our nation from its beginning to now, which is about 29,000 B.C. Our continent follows the general outline of all the others now in manifestation upon the earth. It is about 1,000 miles broad at its widest point, and 3,000 miles long at its longest dimension. The surface is mostly level, consisting of vast fertile plains. But to the west, north and east the country becomes mountainous. From these mountains, as a watershed, a river with its branches drains nearly the whole length of the continent. Its waters, diverted through an artificial canal and locks, forms the great port of the city of Atlantis, which extends from this canal, northeast of the central portion of the continent, quite up to the foothills of the elevated portion of the country. Among these mountains has been built the great temple dedicated to Om, who is the One, the All. Our records fail to give us any information of the beginning of Manu TMS occupancy here, and it is only through the power of perception of our wise men that we gain any idea of that beginning. It is sufficient to say, when the fifth race men needed a home for their unfolding, they found it here. Their unfolding has been along the lines of the strongest development. We may therefore simply describe the conditions now existing as the outcome of the thought forces of the most powerful nation of the known world. The fertility of our soil is unparalleled anywhere upon the earth. Our difference of elevation above the sea level gives variety to our climate, and whatever grows other withers on the globe, will grow here also, in the greatest luxuriance and perfection. We have no need to import anything grown out of the ground from other nations. Our supplies of minerals from the bosom of the earth are incomparable in their amount and abundance. We have all metals found anywhere upon the surface of the earth. We also have one, of which none has ever been discovered in any other country. It possesses the ductility and color of copper and the strength of iron. We have named it Orichalcum. The fauna holds every species of animal, which from here has been carried to all parts of the earth, there to find a new habitat and become of use to the children of men either for labor or pleasure. This was the center of distribution. Whatever knowledge or wisdom on this line experience has given them, they have freely passed it on to those who stood in need of it. In short, whatever mankind possesses in any degree anywhere, we also possess in vast abundance, far beyond our needs. Never has any state, nation or potentate ever before concentrated so much of wealth, that is, surplus of supplies of all kinds, as we hold today. No word but immense will truly describe our public works. No nation has even dreamed of a temple like ours, much less built one. The private residences of our citizens, even of the poorer sort, outshine in beauty of design and suitableness of material the kings of many other nations. Do not consider that I am seeking to belittle others or to extol ourselves, but I am stating as fully and as candidly as I can, that which is really the fact, as I now write. The mountains have springs of hot and cold water which act as natural reservoirs. From them the water is conveyed by stone pipes to the public baths and to the private residences of such citizens as choose to avail themselves of the privilege under certain conditions. In the center of the city are the royal palaces, and these are protected by three immense canals, which are built entirely around them, with two intervening zones of land. These canals are connected with the Great Sea by another canal 300 feet wide and 100 feet deep and 6 miles long to connect with the port. The Great Temple is in the northeast part of the city. Its lofty tower bearing upon its top, the finest observatory ever yet built, occupies the northeast quarter of the temple grounds. This and the temple itself is protected from attack on the north, east and west by the mountains, which serve both as a defense and a foundation to hold up the massive structures built upon them. From the mountains the City of Cities extends in a circular form southward. Beyond the immense area occupied by the city proper is still another, comprising upwards of 75,000 square miles, which has been cultivated from time immemorial, and is in fact one vast garden. This is liberally irrigated from the river and from a canal 600 feet in width and 100 feet deep, extending through the country 1,200 miles. Not only are these waters used for irrigation, but through a system of locks at the port, galleys are raised and lowered into the Grand Canal, where they both receive and distribute cargoes of all kinds of products in the interests of commerce. It is hardly necessary to mention that the population of this plain and the mountains is many millions. Never will there be so many people gathered in the same place at the same time, so say our prophets and magi. Nor must I forget to say that the volume of our population is increased by the fact that owing to the dominance of the life-giving power of the Spirit, which has not been weakened yet to any great extent, there are three or four generations of men upon the earth at the same time, all strong and vigorous. As the necessary supplies for the maintenance of the body at its best are in the greatest profusion, nature in no sense retards the increase of population, but would support to the utmost limit the most prolific increase possible. During the day the myriad sounds of voice and action that arise over the docks and the quarters of the city devoted to labor is like the roar of a tornado on the sea, hurling itself against the embattled rocks. The Atlantean galleys have reached every port and nation under the whole broad heaven. They have laid the entire surface of earth under tribute to our commerce. We have no need to ask another nation for anything we have not. But they seek from us the fruits of our soil and our incomparable bronze manufactures, in whose production our artisans have become very expert, especially in clubs, axes, knives and swords. The barbarians of the Eastern world have never been able to make these things for themselves, and as the material and tempering of our artisans are very fine, we find market for all we can possibly offer. The only article of which we fail in making the supply equal to the demand is a bright yellow metal, which offers a powerful resistance to the action of the elements. It is eagerly sought for purposes of decoration, both of building and persons. The total product of our own mines is thus appropriated, and our traders have discovered that it exists in other parts of the world. So they seek it everywhere, and when found offer our own products in exchange for it. When they bring it home they are offered certain immunities and privileges in addition to the market value for it. Thus, in a way, it has become a measure of value, not only with us, but with all the nations of the earth. It is predicted by our magi that this peculiar condition, through the foul greed of man, will grow into a calamity for the whole race. The desire upon which its gathering by us is founded will become irrepressible and destructive in the more physical nations in the years to come. As, however, our nation has done no intentional wrong and have tried to deal justly, they can hardly be considered responsible for any such evil. It is also true that if evil does come upon the race we shall be forced to meet it in the long ages yet to come, as we are again called to face in new bodies the lives allotted to us. Thus far, strained intensity for acquisition has not acquired force enough to injure us in our development on any line. We are not a nation of flesh eaters, for the warmth of our climate does not compel the concentration of food sought in the use of flesh. It is because we are not bound to the soil in our efforts to overcome the circle of necessity that we can give so much time to the study of the real forces and facts of the universe, and the methods by which they could be made useful to themselves. At the north are three high mountain peaks, which have become landmarks for all seafaring men. In the way of review of what I have written, permit me to take my future readers to the highest summit of the great peak Alivo, and from thence point out the paradise of mountain and valley, hill and plain, interspersed with broad plateau. These are covered with tropical vegetation bearing all kinds of edible fruits known to man throughout the whole circle of the year. Limpid streams from the mountainsides water a large portion of this vast district. Nor is this all, for the whole picture is dotted thick with substantial dwellings, hamlets and towns. But above all, is the capital as a center of interest, and an exchange of thought, so wide, so far-reaching, that all the other centers in the whole country seem but suburbs. Notice also the varied greens of the vegetation and the blue of the sky, so clear and so perfect, as yet undisturbed in its vibrations by the shock of either offense or defense. Beyond these can be seen the canal leading to the landlocked sea and the great port with its fleets of arriving and departing galleys from every quarter of the globe. These galleys move neither by sail nor oar, nor any impulsion of elemental force. Surmounting all these our magi have imparted the secret of etheric impulse born of thought, and against this, wind nor tide have no power. It is the fairest land that man in all his generations thus far has ever seen. The change of condition from life to death is one accepted and welcomed by our people, not in any sense feared, because during their long continued existence the monotony of physical life is fully satisfied and the only inducement for accepting prolongation is the increasing of the spiritus force and potency, with which we are well acquainted and fully educated as to its limitless possibilities. Our place as carriers for the world, has for many years been acknowledged. On all seas and in every port are the galleys that supply the world at TMS Mars, flying the Atlantean flag a winged globe in blue on a yellow ground. It therefore happens in our ample harbor, the myriad swarms of shipping, although loaded with the products of the whole earth are ours. The sailors of other nations dare not move out into the vast wastes of waters, separating the different countries one from another. Great warehouses lie along the water at TMS edge, which is bordered from the sea, for many miles into the interior, by immense, solidly built walls. These are raised high enough to be above any high water mark of either flood from the interior or tide from the ocean. But floods were rather the result of changes in the amount of drainage, for the melting of snow on the mountains or increase of amount from suddenly precipitated vapor, was a thing of but slight importance. The capital is connected with all parts of the kingdom by iron tramways, upon which enormous loads are moved by a motive force, whose secret only our magi know. But the obedient force moves back and forth, drawing and pushing, as it is bidden by its controller, the heavily laden wagons, to which it is harnessed. The whole city is built of a pure white marble, taken from quarries in the northern hills, whose supplies are used not only for building at home, but also for export. So fine is the grain and so elegant the polish that the blocks are used over and over in rebuilding in the cities of the Mediterranean. This stone cannot endure the extremes of temperature of the northern climate, but is amply strong for all that may be demanded under an Atlantean sky. From what I have already said, perhaps it will be plain, the city is laid out like a disc, with a segment wanting, where it is fitted against the foothills of the northern mountain ranges. Broad avenues in semicircle begin at the mountains and end in the mountains. These are crossed at regular intervals by other avenues, forming the radii of the circle, the center of which is the King of TMS Palace. There is no ownership of land, save in the King of TMS name as the representative of the nation. It is held by our magi, that no man can own anything in which his own labor, or some representative thereof, does not constitute a component part. All articles of handiwork therefore can be claimed by the contributors thereto, but man has not, and can never attain, ownership in the four great elements of manifestation: fire, air, water, earth. If he ever shall attempt it, disaster and degradation will attend the attempt. If a man builds a house or plants a tree, or cultivates a crop, then the house or tree or harvest belong to him, and he should be protected in his right to enjoy fully, all that can come from his labor. All lands are parceled out by lot, and the improvements only, have a price. He who would like his neighbor at TMS location must, with his neighbor at TMS consent, buy the improvements, but the land has no more value than the air about it. The houses are built for convenience and comfort. Every family owns its own home, and when a young man takes to himself a wife, he has a portion of land assigned him, under conditions which make equable all inequalities of place, quality or surroundings. No crowding is allowed, not even in the thickest part of the city. The buildings are of permanent material, fashioned to let in the air and light. The underlying principle is a central open court, with the living rooms all about it. This plan is modified in many ways to suit the individualities and needs of the owners. The court is entered by a broad gate, swinging easily on its ample fittings. In the center, a pool with an overflowing fountain to prevent stagnation, cools the air and helps modify the vibrations. The water was supplied by an aqueduct from the mountains. This was so old that no Atlantean of the present people can give its age. But there are records in the archives of the temple concerning the planning of the huge undertaking and the manner of its accomplishment. About this pool, the building stands, generally two stories, so supported on pillars, as to form no obstruction to free movement of the air. When the young couple decide to locate, it is the custom to receive from the chief astrologer of the temple a horoscope definitely naming the number of the new family to come. For each one, a room was built in the home. This special allotment prevents crowding, and is productive to the utmost, of progress and growth on all lines. Animals herd, man individualizes in his tendency. At either end of the scale, acceptation of, or rebellion against the herding, indicates where he stands at any given time, as regards either his spiritual or his physical nature. If he is inclined to be brutish, it matters not if 50 hands eating with his, dip into the same bowl of porridge. If he is spiritually unfolded, he would prefer to appropriate and use, in his own way, that which comes belonging to and prepared especially for himself. This is not, as it might at the outset appear, selfishness, but is the outcropping of the work which the ego takes upon itself during the earth lives, the soul building out of the incarnations. The rooms on the first story are larger and mostly used for the offices of living, in which the family relations are concerned and perfected. Most of their leisure time is spent about the fountain in the court, where there are always agreeable shadows, with the blue sky above. The courts are paved in colored patterns with a kind of glass, and carpeted with rugs and mats woven from vegetable textiles and fancifully dyed. These goods are made principally for export. Besides these furnishings, there are side by side, products of Mana Thames thought from every part of the earth, the richest and the best. None are blood-stained as the spoils of war, for our traffic, industrious and honorable, has made us beyond a doubt the richest nation that ever existed upon the earth. From the first, we have traded everywhere. No galley of ours has ever been seized by the god of the seas and left lying upon the ocean bottom, whether bearing our goods forth or bringing back to us the merchandise of other lands. This natural increase by labor and by trade, without loss, should of itself have been sufficient to have enriched us without other means. Thus it is perceived the families are by themselves, each is an independent community. Their houses and gardens are as much the kingdom of that community as can possibly be conceived. This is the rule of the spiritual and not of the physical. But I must not forget to speak of the streets and roads of the city proper and the outlying country. These are laid out on a certain general plan, which once established has never been changed. Although they have been many years in construction and extension, every foot has been added under the direction of a mastermind in conformity to a uniform plan adopted thousands of years ago. So far as they are extended, they are finished and lasting. The substance used for the roadbeds is our secret, of the whole world. Our ways are dustless and noiseless. The peculiar composition readily yields traction to bodies moving over them. Never has there been so perfect a system of easy transportation upon the earth. The public buildings are always large, roomy and of varied styles, surmounted with domes, pinnacles and minarets and ornamented with statues of artistic design and workmanship. The material of which these are built is white marble. Atlantis can well claim not only the honor of being so created, but of remaining a white city. There is no darkening effluvium in the air nor the climate to obscure white walls set in the great billows of surrounding green. Our magi say, that in days to come, a nation on the Mediterranean Sea called the Greeks, will personify in their works of art. Our beloved city is a beautiful woman rising from the sea. The more important of these buildings are profusely decorated with gold, and it is for this purpose that this metal is so eagerly bought by the Atlantean traders. A poetical name, the Tears of the Sun, has been adopted by our people, and by this it is most widely called here. Of the palace of the king, of the great temple, I will speak more at length by and by. In these public buildings are rooms for social meetings, to discuss public topics and for the convenience of classes studying things that do not belong to the physical plane. A description of one will be a description of the general plan of all. They are elliptical in form, with a fountain in the center. The Atlanteans are extravagantly fond of the presence of water. At one of the loci are a number of seats, arranged like an amphitheater, built of stone and rising one above another. At the other of the loci stands a tribune, upon which the speaker stands when public addresses are made. About the fountain also are seats, where the auditors sit easily and converse one with another. In like manner are built the training schools of the young, the central part of the structure being open to the sunlight and the air. Here the young Atlanteans are educated in the things that belong to the nation, the family and to themselves. Our fathers had a saying, we seek to make a rule of living, 8 years to infancy and play, 8 years to boyhood and training in physical things, 8 years to young manhood and learning of the world outside of Atlantis, and 1,000 years to learning of the invisible and real. These proportions are very nearly correct. Our story of Atlantis, part 2. The Atlanteans of either sex are almost perfect in their physical organizations. They are nearly all equally trained by the Master of Wisdom. It may be asked why they are not all on the same plane of development. The reply is the conclusive answer of all ages and times. Man never has and never will exercise his individual potency in exactly the same way. The little variation, hardly perceptible at first, is increased by every increment, no matter how small, of each of the succeeding lives. This difference is increased also by the force of intellectual power which comes to a nation and of necessity to the individuals of the nation, who will seek to occupy the best bodies and positions, as the returning egos claim place in the lives. Because of the absolute equality of the sexes, the bodies of the women are just as strong and vigorous as those of the men. But we know that in other nations, with which we have come in contact, in other parts of the world, the women are inferior in size and strength. This happens because the people of those nations have allowed themselves from generation to generation, and from age to age, to believe in and assert the inferiority of women. This continued thought has belittled and dwarfed her, not only in body, but has also bound her aspirations and her mental capacity with bonds stronger than steel. While the barbarian races, to their sorrow and loss, have made this sad mistake, the Atlantean nation, on the other hand, have constantly held to the equality of the sexes. The result now is, physically, both sexes are models which painter or sculptor are proud and eager to paint. The action of the climate and transmitted principles have brought intellectual vigor and daring with a marvelous grasp of perception upon the laws of nature and of themselves. Their bodies, instead of being impediments to spiritual growth and advancement, are helps indeed to the spirits who seek through them experience, knowledge and understanding. Those who might be called the common class, doing the necessary labor of the nation, are far advanced beyond the literary class of the barbarian nations in their perception of the truth and their knowledge of naturae laws. The day will come in the future when men will mourn this knowledge forgotten, when the fatigue and monotony of burden-bearing will be almost overwhelming in its crushing awfulness. We have schools for the development of the physical and for the directing of the mental habits of thought. In these schools very little memorized knowledge is imparted. The design is to so train the faculties that if desired or needed the cipher of the astral books could easily be read. Sickness is unknown. We have no lame, halt, blind, deaf nor dumb, nor beggars as models for maternal prenatal mind, to misform embryos, and thus build monstrosities for the public charge. This of which I speak is true of the nations who are busy in the affairs of commerce, of agriculture, or who are builders and decorators of houses and public buildings. But there are some who from natural impulsion have sought more and more of the invisible, of the truths which belong to the One, and those who rest in it. These are willing and anxious to devote themselves and their powers constantly to obtaining and attaining, and the teaching of youth. The only class distinction we have is founded upon knowledge. It has come to pass in a natural fashion that these thinkers have gravitated toward one another, that they have kept records of observation, experiment and experience, that they are wiser in speech, in mathematics as applied to the unseen, in alchemy, in astrology, and they are specially wise in the physics which embrace the laws of the unseen. At first buildings were set apart for these students and their teachers. As the city grew, each body of students had its building, now known as temples. Later, all were gathered into the one great temple, in order that the symbolism of the One who is all might be perfect. In the teachings of our Magi, all manifestation, on all planes, is referred back to the One, as the single central source of strength and power for everything obtained and obtainable. Thus the mind dwelling on this thought has striven in design, in material, in finishing and furnishing to make the great temple a perfected symbol of the One. Its worship in all its imagery and suggestion combines every element for the impressiveness of mode and subject, under discussion upon the minds of the student. Is it any wonder that there has come to us as a nation a deep-seated veneration for the omnipotent name and laws? It is also a fact that our Magi are in possession of most wonderful powers, in the control of elemental forces who obey their will, coming to their tasks, not under confinement, but because obedient to the will and behest of those who call singly or unitedly for their services. It is also known that this power never will be held except by Atlantean-born people, regardless of the changing conditions of the globe. It is also true that a far greater proportion of our people have attained to the superior light and knowledge than any other nation upon the earth, either in the past or present. This is doubtless due to the fact that our incarnating egos, having the right of choice, have again and again sought their own people as the most privileged spot in which to make advancement during their lives. When these advanced egos have found their bodies, we have the spectacle of children born old, for the brightness of the last life is heavy on them, and the newness of the body does not always act as a defense or shield from its imperious blaze. It is not in each, but is a matter of ordinary, detailed development. We have but one basic law called the Golden Rule or preference throughout the whole country and city. It is of another before self. We have no evils arising out of the action of selfishness, for this condition is the primary result of the fear of destitution, either for ourselves or others, sometime during the position or period of earth life. Even they who are the least advanced understand from our teaching the true idea of brotherhood, that no man, no manitms wife, no manitms children, can, under the law, suffer from deprivation of the necessities of physical life. He who has more than enough is held to be always the steward in trust for him who temporarily has less than enough. But this does not relieve from the necessity for labor, of every individual in the direct ratio of their ability, at whatever employment they are best fitted. In the building of our houses, the quarrying of the stones, the transportation and the fitting is all done by elemental force, under the direction of a master, who is in charge of a section. It is his duty to educate them and to see that they are duly provided for, out of the astral storehouse, by the power given into his hands. This form of government has already been copied from us by a powerful nation in the northern part of Asia, but because of their situation on the physical plane, it is most likely they will be able to retain only the form, and will lose the spiritual power which is the foundation and potent principle. The whole nation is linked together by the master of the families. These are in groups and classes, under instruction and direction from those who are most competent to teach. These teachers are grouped under the masters or magi of the temple. These magi of the temple are under the instruction of the most ancient, the seven, the five and the three. So, in the hands of the three, mightiest of all human intellects, rests the destinies, the prosperity and the happiness of the whole nation. Moreover, upon them as directors and arbiters, the responsibility of karmic conditions rested, as they were engendered by the currents of potency issuing from themselves and returning upon their cycle bore with them, whatever had been impressed upon, or mingled with them during their evolvement among those to whom the currents were sent. It must be apparent, to whom this story of Atlantis may come, that the power of the unseen, and its application to Manetium's earth life are matters of the greatest interest and importance to the Atlanteans. There is no temporal power, save as a symbol of the manifested. Everything pertaining to organized effort originates with, and is carried forward by the priesthood of the great temple, which represents the dominant power over matter of the spirit at its highest and best. They are specially in charge of the study and development of all occult knowledge. Every house is independent of itself. The Atlanteans are monogamists, the one husband of one wife. This experience has demonstrated to be the best condition for the development of a strong, spiritual race. We have seen that polygamist races always decrease in power, strength and energy of purpose. In Atlantis, to be diseased or crippled in body, or to be at the head of a family, in which there is such a member, is deemed a crime against the people. Therefore all thought, all desire and interest are brought to bear upon physical conditions, through occult and spiritual forces, not only to make the nation whole, but whole in the highest and best sense. Those who are particularly gifted with psychic qualities, or whose spirits have attained familiarity with the instruments entrusted to their hands are trained for the offices of masters or guides. These may or may not have families, but in either case, they are persons to whom a certain number of persons or families look for counsel, advice and guidance. For thousands of years have the Magi of the temple, who give their whole time to the study of the unseen, and lay aside their bodies at their own volition, really placed the welfare and best good of the people beyond any other consideration whatever. The nation is happy. They have no poor. They have no inferior class. All necessary labor is honorable. Generation after generation, we have been growing stronger and more like the gods come down to earth. We have perfect communication with the outside world and each other. We know Atlantis is the fairest city on this planet, and we are content. Excerpts from our story of Atlantis, Part 3. To the northeast of this island continent is located the great temple, built both for use and symbolism. On a plateau of many acres in extent, where the gradually rising ground began to break into the foothills, the whole surface had been leveled and paved with some soft material, of which the Atlanteans alone knew the secret. This hardened under the action of the sun and atmosphere, until it was like adamant. To the east, a belt of country reaching to the seacoast, but not on a level with it, had also been smoothed and paved, so that there was no obstruction to the eye, until it rested on the far-off horizon. Upon this broad expanse of level space, close enough to the mountains to be buttressed by their mighty arms, stood the great, white-walled temple, facing the south, and the ample areas for assemblage. The closed courts and offices, and the cloisters of the temple faced the mountains of the north, and thus secured for the temple dwellers the privacy needed for the masters and student brotherhoods of the temple, who were seeking to know out of the silence. The temple proper consists of two stories, the first one consisting of pillars springing from the rocky foundations of the mountain and supporting arches, which in turn, held up immense slabs of stone, the floors of the second story. On the first floor there is little or no enclosure, but within the walls of the second story it is all arranged for privacy and quiet thought. He who looks over the battlements of the upper story, looks down about 90 feet, into the beautifully paved court below. On the east and west of the temple itself, are gardens, groves of trees, fountains, running streams of water, domesticated animals, and flowers of every hue and fragrance. These are sacred to the temple, but open to the people under the surveillance of the caretakers, except certain reserved spots close to the temple, which are for the special use of the students and teachers. In the northeast section of the temple building was the great tower and observatory, 50 feet in diameter, rising 210 feet, a landmark and light extending hundreds of miles and ever adjoins Spira for the sea-tossed mariners of the state. Looking from the plaza in front, toward the interior of the temple, its vast recesses, its forests of white pillars and its high-lifted overarching roof fills the spectator with awe. Nor was this feeling lessened by the cleanliness, the continuous shifting of huge masses of sunlight and shadow, ever into new and indescribable grotesquery. During the services, the awful solemnity evoked was of a character that modified the whole Atlantean thought and national purpose. The great tower was commenced 15 feet below the surface. The original trap rock was supplemented by a square block of concrete rock, and upon this was carried up the superstructure to a total height of 225 feet, the square of 15. Upon the floor of the temple resting on a raised dais was the secret chamber of the Holy of Holies. Across and through this, at high festivals, blazed and flashed the veil of Isis. Above, on a level with the upper floor, was the chamber of the 45, and still above that the chambers of the 15, the 7, the 5 and the 3. In the outer, the tower was smooth and unpenetrated on its surface from bottom to top. It resembled a solid block, chiseled out of quarries and set on end, so deft was the workmanship and so perfect the jointings and finish. In the cloisters and rooms of the second story of the temple were the apartments for private study and class instruction. There were also supplemental apartments, hollowed out of the neighboring mountains and reached by secret passages so arranged that whatever should be deposited in them as treasuries would be securely held, even if buried beneath the surface of the sea for ages. Beyond the great plaza, toward the city, trees and fountains shaded and beautified clear up to the naked edge of the vast pavement. This is a faint portrayal of that which was really the culmination and concentration of the national TMS thousands of years of existence and unfolding. In all our temples, and more especially in the great temple, the outer courts were but the simple separation from those who have no inspiration for the inner and higher. In the outermost court, or court of the people, were always gathered those who had thoughts of their own, and who were undecided as to what direction they should take in pursuit of the light slowly dawning upon them. The inner court of the people contained those who have so far perceived that they are willing to obligate themselves to carry out certain purposes, of whose full intent they can know but little, except that the farther end is lost in the light of life, and the halo of obligation. In this court they who seek must be fitted by training and preparation for that which lies before them, so it is natural that they who linger there, striving to advance, must do whatever they can through their own power of assimilation, by themselves. At the first, if the lesson is concentration, it is their individual concentration. If the lesson is passivity, it is their own individual passivity. It is exactly as when one is learning to sing, as a beginning, the voice is trained to use its own peculiar function alone. After this solitary practice, when some aptitude has been attained and a facility of use, then they are ready for the massing of singles for a united effort. It must follow then, that the outer court of the Brotherhood cannot but lap over into the inner court of the temple. That which is done singly and alone, is absolutely necessary for the next step in advance, which is to be made in unison with another or others, in the same way as musical students are trained by twos and fours for united efforts of action and harmony. The question considered in all this is, how shall growth and attainment be best accomplished? What is the basic principle? In music we say the sounds are set to a certain key, and however prolonged the action of the vibrations, the key and time will be the same, and all the vibrations are aligned. It is exactly thus, when the students come to act together on the occult planes, the vibrations which they produce will not, of course, be alike, but they must chord, the parts of one vibration fitting and filling in with the vibrations of another, so there shall be no jangle. To get the best results, it is always best that they who are in the outer court of the Brotherhood should be watchful and careful lest the vibrations sent forth from themselves should be hastened or intensified or even dragged through the thoughtlessness of their own carelessness. When once unity of action is attempted in this matter, It is absolutely necessary to success that the key on which they start should remain the same. It is easy to see how intense passions, such as anger, or any of the disturbing conditions would interfere with the vibrations. It would be like a chord out of tune in a stringed instrument, where, though the strings do not give out the same sounds, still they must be in alignment. This alignment is the source of all music. It is not needful that the most intense feelings of an ETMS nature should be given rein, and allowed to make disturbance, both for himself and those whom he is contracting. It is also, on a small scale, like the sharping and flatting at the wrong points, whereby the vibrations are changed, the harmony broken and discord becomes perceptible. It is also absolutely necessary that all conditions in the outer which can cause a disturbance should be held in abeyance, when one desires to concentrate, in order that during a united effort for concentration the harmony and strength shall not be marred. This is true of all work on any occult line. It is not to be supposed when two or more of the brothers are concentrating, exactly the same process is gone through within the mind of each. That would be impossible. The end sought for can be attained by each working in his own way, with the same thought. It does not follow because A does not perform his task exactly as B does, that B should set up a disturbance in the vibration as reflected from A, thus in a measure destroying the cooperation and effect to be produced. The law of the temple then, is first, alone, second, in company with those who are seeking by united force to accomplish, as the masters of destiny, at all times, have been able to accomplish. Unity of action is most important, therefore we must guard against anything that can disturb this unity. If vibrations, in their normal conditions lay along side by side, and one is hastened, then the harmony is destroyed and the action of the impulse is to increase the vibrations in the length of their wave force. We must, when meeting for united effort, insist that each for themselves shall become their own guardians. Knowing that disagreeable things will occur, we must be ever prepared, at once, to put them aside. Having done this once, we shall be stronger to continue. Thus the music from our solar TMS action will not only affect ourselves, but those about us. Upon this statement of principles has been built the great law of the temple, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. All the teaching and training, all the ceremonies and symbolism of the temple are founded upon this law as the cornerstone of the religion of our people. Having given this brief summary of the truths, our priesthood of in charge, let us pass on to a description of some of the ceremonies of the temple service, and, as an illustration, we will take the great feast of the new year, as more fully including the whole, than any other. The feast of the new year, on the 21st of March, consummated and commemorated the Sunar TMS rebirth, when, out of equal days and nights a new spring and summer began for the Northern Hemisphere, and the promise of seed time and harvest was renewed. At this celebration it is expected that every family in the kingdom should be present, either personally or represented by some member of the family. All the going and coming of the year is planned with this in view. It is considered a privilege for all the outlying population to be made welcome in the capital at this time. The feast lasts 7 days. Let me attempt to describe at length, for no pen can truly portray all the wonders of that marvelous assemblage, one of the last feasts which took place, 10 years before the destruction of the city. The government and people were at that time in their most perfect unity. About 3 days before the set date of the feast there could be noticed a little stir of preparation all over the country. It was a quiet movement toward participation. If one had been lifted above, so he could have looked upon the continent as upon a map, there would have been perceived during these 3 days, long lines of travelers, some on foot, and others by every method of conveyance, moving upon the city in converging lines. As the time grew shorter the extent of these lines grew shorter and the ways close to the city and in the city itself were filled to overflowing. There were but few people in the outlying country who had not some friend or relative in the city proper. When the houses were filled, tents were spread in the gardens, and in all the parks and places of assembly. Thus there was a new appearance given to the light by its reflection from the tents, which were some of linen and some of cotton, but all bleached very white by a process known only to the Atlanteans and never imparted to any other nationality. Only on the great plateau of the temple and the areas of the outer courts, no tents were allowed, for that space was necessarily kept clear, that there might be room for the greater assembly. As the ceremonies were in commemoration of the newborn sun, the hours of assembly were morning and evening, and at the moment of the meridian height. On the first day of the feast, as the dawn brightened in the east, out of the early twilight, there could be heard throughout the whole city a low, muffled sound like the pouring of a swift torrent through a smooth bed, and as soon as it was light enough to see all the outer courts and the great plateau of the temple could be perceived, crowded with those who had arrived to take part in the inauguration ceremonies. Their faces were turned toward the east, between whose far horizon and the eyes of the numberless watchers no obstruction intervened. When the moment approaches for the appearance of the ruler of the day, a low, sweet harmony, sounding in rhythmic change, welled out upon the air in slow, restful time and far-reaching tones, from the great temple choir, who were gathered in one of the porches of the temple, so raised as to be seen by all the vast multitude. As the sounds of the chant gradually swelled by the voices of the worshippers, became more intense in power and heavier in volume, all the vast multitude seemed to sway, under the psychic spell of this invocation to the sun, this symbol of welcome to one who returns to his work and purpose. The minutes move quickly on, the invocation is finished, a blast of trumpets accompanying the final note, the orb of day, with tropical suddenness springs from his bed beneath the sea. As his first beams fall upon the countless multitude, they drop upon their knees. With bowed heads, in silent adoration, they ascribe all glory, all power, all praise to that which stands to them as the manifested source of life, of health, of strength, the ever-sleepless eye of the One. Then they separate. The hours are spent in social converse, or the abandonment of rest and quiet until it is high noon. As the sun approaches the meridian, all the streets and byways, all the housetops, in all places where there may be a worshipper, behold his face turned towards the temple. At the moment of meridian altitude, above the highest pinnacle, a crystal ball, almost as dazzling in its brilliancy as the sun itself, shoots up, and for a few moments receives the concentrated thought of all the faithful throughout the city, as the reminder of the good messenger of the One, the height of whose glory is now perceived. Again, in the evening there is a convocation at the temple. The ceremonies of the morning are repeated, with the exception that the song is one of farewell, the multitude facing the west instead of the east, and the hushing sounds of stringed instruments attend his exit from the western horizon. These ceremonies are continued for 6 days. There are various other ceremonies which take up the time of portions of the convocation, between these assemblies of the whole. There are also lines of temple services, work and study. Each of the sciences having its appropriate place and each being developed by those who are allied in the great brotherhood of the temple. This embraced the whole people in its ramifications. It is not necessary to describe these in all their minutiae. But during these 6 days there was continually something taking place in the city, always having its moving force at the temple. The moving of a procession through the streets, a convening of the temple guides or guards, lectures and talks from those who were so well qualified to give forth from full fountains to the inner souls, eager to be fed. But as the evening draws on after the waning of the 6th day, once more, all the courts of the temple were thronged. The hum of conversation dies away as the darkness grows more and more intense. Now, when it shall have become quite dark, the temple choir opens the exercises with the song of invocation. It differs from all the music of the convocation, hitherto, in key, rhythm and time. In this all the people join. As the sound vibrates in swelling cadence, rising and falling amongst the echoing mountains, the effect was perfectly indescribable, for the Atlanteans were especially celebrated for being sweet singers. When the singing was finished, the chief instructor of the people stood upon a tribune high raised, and the discoursed of the things which concerned them most intimately in the physical life, of whatever they stood most in need, of how the sun was to them life and health, and plenty and peace, the sign and representative of all good. Then he directed their attention to the darkness, which sat so uneasily upon them, enforcing rest and inability to work. Then his peroration was after this fashion: the darkness is death and desolation, and thus, in the beginning, the existent saw, when he said, A let the be, and there was, light. At this word millions of lights gleamed out all over the temple, inside, outside, even on the highest points. It stood forth one blaze of white marble glory, for there was only one thing about electricity the Atlanteans do not know. That is the point where knowledge lays hold with potency upon the One, in its inmost and supreme integrity of existence. There are other ceremonies of minor importance, pertaining to the night, but this is the most important. There are no sacrifices, no shedding of the blood of animal or human victims. The Atlanteans do not believe it is necessary to teach destruction or destructive action by such sacrifice, in the burning or destroying of any living thing, for they say man is naturally destructive and we ought to teach him the opposite. So all our ceremonies lack the hideous shadow of agony and horror, that will be sure to come if man forgets our teachings. But the great object lessons served well their purpose in elevating the whole people to the same level, and cementing them into a common brotherhood. Here we have come to the end of the extracts.